All right, welcome back. So hopefully everyone is still healthy and staying well. And if you are sick, I hope you're taking care of yourself and things are you're being supported in your life. Please reach out to Sims or to other people if you need support. So tonight, I'd like to just do a recap on last night's talk, last week's talk on Namarupa. So Namarupa, as we talked about in the guided meditation, is really pointing toward this bare attention that we try to cultivate as meditators. This willingness just to see, just to feel, just to sense, without having to add anything to that experience. But so often we do add. We add countless times in a day. A sound arises and we have a label to it, and our reaction grows right from that label. We have a cessation, we have a tickle in our throats, and we think, oh no, maybe I'm getting sick. It's such a quick process that we find ourselves going from one point of reactivity to another. So dependent origination gives us this ability to open this process up. And by the process I'm talking about is really the process of suffering, how we create this cycle of suffering moment after moment, how we create the sense of self moment after moment. Suffering and selfing are one and the same. This is what's described in the Second Noble Truth. Now, the name and form is such a fascinating way to look at things because our assumption is the way we perceive the world, the way we experience it, is pretty accurate, is actually pretty close to reality. And yet, as meditators, we start to see how quickly we misperceive things. We see something, we sense something, and our ideas of it come up, a whole thought stream around it comes up. And then we realize, oh, I was mistaken about that. We start to see the power of our thinking mind and how it can really distort and really create this sense of reality that we go through life in. This is, of course, the seeds of some of the most painful ways we interact with each other. When we hold someone as other, someone who is unlike us, that we have our prejudice, our racism, our bias against flows up, and we react to them not from who they actually are, but actually through our misconception of who they are. So Namarupa is a way to start to see that, to see how the name that we place and the impulse to act from that name come together to create this cycle of suffering. It's almost like we take out one of those wind-up toys, the old ones with the spring in it, and you take your key and you turn it, and the more you turn it, the faster it goes when you release it. It's like that winding up process is as we go through these cycles, these 12 steps of dependent origination, each step we start to put a little bit more wind in it. Going back to ignorance and sankharas, it's like this kind of background tendency. The consciousness is this sensitivity, this kind of bias of our awareness to pick up one aspect of consciousness versus another. Then we come into Namarupa to name and form, then suddenly we've really wound that up. It's becoming much tauter, much more has this capacity to spring. We've really narrowed that down. And then it's just waiting for the right trigger to arise, like a mousetrap set with the cheese on it. And when that point of what triggers a mousetrap is that contact, that sensation, that thought, that sound, that word, that experience. Really, to be more accurate, it seemed like it all arises at once on this point of contact, but there's a sense of kind of predisposition, pre-programming. It sets us up to be to how that mousetrap explode. So last week I talked about the example of a tree. And we could look at a tree and think, oh, everyone's going to agree on that tree. But yet, based on maybe our profession or our experience, if you were like my grandfather, whenever he had tree in his front yard when he moved to a new house, he would immediately cut that tree down so it would not get into the storms or to the sewer system and cause lots of expense. While another person may look at the tree and say, wow, that provides so much shade to my house. I really appreciate that. Another person may look at it and say, how that's blocking my view and we should get rid of it. An arborist will look at how it's growing. A logger will look at how many square foot of board feet they could get from it. A child might look at it and say, well, I can build a treehouse there or put a swing. The exact same phenomenon, the exact same thing out in the physical world, through our experience, our perceptions, our misconceptions, our training, our actions, our predisposes us to perceive that in a particular way. Each of those ways of perceiving has this embedded way of acting. It's like a carrier message that the name and the action that comes to that name come one and the same. This is the nama rupa, the image of the people in the boat, the rowboat, that they're steering it and they're acting and moving in a certain direction. Also, nama rupa is considered the five aggregates and how those all come together with the way we perceive and interface with the world and how we create this sense of suffering. So the good news is this is all optional, how we create suffering, this misperception. It's something we can actually use our practice to see through. Sometimes we take it in different elements, maybe working on the ignorance part or the sankhara part. And now we can look at that sense of name and form, how we name something and how we act from that. Now, of course, those names sometimes have a lot of charge to them. There's a lot of tension built up in those springs. I use the example of cross-country skiing and going up a hill, and the further up you go and turn around, the more momentum you have going down. So it's like we have all these hills that we've skied up and we've just kind of left our skis there. And suddenly our wife says something to us or our spouse or our boss or a stranger, and we find ourselves strapped under those skis facing downhill, about to run into this whole cycle of suffering. The cycle of suffering. It can happen almost immediately. And this process of, I use the example of this tree, you know, as a hopefully a benign way to kind of open your mind to this idea. But the same exact process happens with some things which are much more charged, much more urgent. Say, for example, we have this underlying sense of inadequacy, the sense that there's something lacking in me, something that's not quite sufficient. So like that sense of not good enough is this, the spring is already set, you know, or maybe just kind of latent in the background. And then someone says something to us, or we hear something, or we get jealous about someone else's success. And suddenly that whole process becomes activated. And before we know it, we're lost in our papancha, our worry, our obsession. We're lost kind of in a down mood. And it has this grippingness to it. Our whole world seems to coalesce and contract around this one experience, this one thought, this one belief. So this is an example of name and form. Again, just a sound, maybe someone saying, you know, I'm doing really well, and you realize I'm not doing so well. And suddenly the sense of inadequacy supercharges us into this selfing, into this sense of suffering that we'll explore as the year goes on, going into contact and vedana and clinging and craving and becoming and birth. So practice is much about learning how we create suffering and also how to release from suffering. As the Buddha is often quoted as saying, I teach one thing, suffering and the end of that suffering. So how to interrupt this cycle of dependent origination? How do we interrupt this process of selfing? This point of how do we do this? How do we interrupt? There's different entry ways we can do this. Now, last week, we talked about it from how the name and form can set up but we can play with it, especially if it's not so charged. Kind of play with seeing something from a different perspective, seeing it from a different sense of identity, really. And so something like the tree, if I was a logger and I get so focused on the square foot of wood I can get from that, I switched to maybe, well, if I was a kid, I wanted to put a tree house in there. I wanted to enjoy the shade of that tree. So that shifting of how you perceive it is like a shifting of the name and form. But what's really happening in this process is we're willing to set aside this investment in this sense of me, the sense of me that has all its expression of opinions, of contraction, of judgment, of ideas, of reactivity, and be willing to pick up a different sense of me, shifting that name and form. And ultimately, the process isn't, the point of the process isn't learning how to shift the sense of self, but to see how that sense of self itself is not so substantial. If I'm able to shift, how substantial can it be? So it starts to loosen this much deeper well of ignorance, which drives, is the ultimate driver of dependent origination, the ultimate driver of our suffering, our optional, unnecessary suffering. Now, when we really get engaged in a pattern, like let's say that inadequacy, it can be so gripping. And what happens when it gets gripped is our whole reality contracts around that. We've created really, literally, our whole world for that moment. Our whole world is biased toward this mind state and the beliefs that flow from it. It's really hard to talk ourselves out of those times, because everything kind of cycles back. It's like a closed loop that each thought reinforces the other thoughts. Because what's happened is we've created this reality, this world that we're living in. You know, the dependent origination is this becoming and this birth. We're living in this world, this idea, and the games of that, the rules of that game, the parameters keep us self-contained in that quality of suffering. So here's the saving grace, that the dependent origination, each cycle is dependent upon the previous one. That's the dependent origination. That if the previous loop or link starts to fall away, then the link that we're engaged with starts to fall away too. So the previous link, as we spoke of last week, or last month, I should say, was consciousness. Now that this is consciousness is the sense of the room that holds our experience, kind of the vista that we look out, what we're sensitive to, what we're aware of, and what we're asleep to. So name and form just adds a specificness, a specificity to that consciousness. It gives the consciousness something to land upon, to receive, to focus on, and the action that flows from that. So then we can use this to shift that sense of consciousness. So the Buddha was having a dialogue with another monk. And this monk asked the Buddha, "Name and form, dear sir, tell me, when asked this, where are they brought to a halt? Where are they brought to a halt? How is name and form brought to a halt, including all the proliferation of suffering, all the proliferation of reactivity that can form from that name and form?" This is this gripping quality that we're so strongly believing in this expression of reality. And the Buddha replied to this question, how do they brought to a halt? "The question you've asked, I'll answer it for you. Where name and form are brought to a halt without a trace, with the sensation of consciousness, they're brought to a halt." Right? So when name and form are brought to a halt, when consciousness, when the previous link is also brought to a halt. So what does this look like in our practice? What's this practical way of focusing on that? Let's say we're caught in that obsessive thinking, this sense of inadequacy and how we we heard that comment from a friend, and then suddenly we're just caught in rehashing all our past inadequacy, projecting to the future how we'll continue to be inadequate. That's the consciousness of the mind and mental consciousness. So remember, we have another five we could choose from. So learning to shift our attention to another element of consciousness, like the visual consciousness, looking at the beautifulness of the springtime, the flowers, the play of the sun upon the green. Consciously shift our attention to the sound of birds in the morning. And if we can, this is tricky, because we have to be willing to let go of the lure of being someone who's upset, someone who's hurt, someone who's inadequate. You have to be willing to let go of that, to let that sense of self that's arisen fade, to pass, and allow our consciousness to shift to something else. So in that shifting, it often is, it's a sense of renunciation, a sense of letting go, of being willing to not be right, to be willing to go into the unknown. And if we're able to connect with that different quality of consciousness, again, this is something that we can do right in this very moment, wherever you're sitting, whatever environment you're in. There's the consciousness of the mind that's hearing and thinking and reacting. There's also the consciousness of sound that's hearing the sounds in your room of the pets and the car traffic and maybe the wind. There's this consciousness of body sensations, of the breath, the sensation of the body sitting. So all these different qualities we can shift our attention to, and be willing to settle our attention on that, to something that really is quite profound. It allows this world that we've created, that we're so convinced of its reality, to suddenly vanish, to fall away. Until we recall ourselves, oh, I'm supposed to be upset about this, and we reset the whole cycle. And so learning how to be fluid, to go from one moment to another, to find a place of balance, really tending to our minds, tending to our reactivity. This is our responsibility. And the moment has these mouse traps, this pre-set tendencies. But when that arises, that's when our responsibility comes up. So how do we tend to our reactivity? How do we attend to our hearts? And as we do this, we find that our actions naturally tend to align with our hearts, align with non-harm, with generosity, with compassion. In this way, we find that our lives become transformed, not from something we intended to do, but simply we start to see the world not through our ignorance, through our unconscious qualities, but actually connecting with it how it is, with nam and rupa just being something that arises without a statement of reality. All right, let's just sit quietly for a few moments, letting those words settle. Thank you for your attention, your kind attention. And so I'd like to propose that we go into some small groups. And before everybody jumps off who doesn't want to be, you're welcome to, if you'd rather not be in a small group, you could jump off the site, but then come back on in about 8:30. Then we can do some larger group questions and answers. So I'll fumble a little bit here while we let people who want to be in the small groups, they can jump off. But again, come back about 8:30 if you'd like to hear the larger questions. And so I want to send a chat out with last week's homework. The little luck. Okay, good. All right, so hopefully you can see the chat on your screen. It's either on your right or maybe the highlighted yellow bubble at the bottom. So we can think of Nama Rupa, the name and form, as this label we place upon something and the impulse to act relative to that label. This often becomes a fast trip into reactivity and wanting. Practice pausing when you find yourself in a state of reactivity. What label are you assigning to the target of reactivity? Notice the impulse of movement or action embedded in that label. Can you shift to a different conditioning around that object? How would this shift your reactivity? So if you're able to practice with it this week, or just recalling in your own, maybe throughout the talk or something that's happening right now, how that sense of reactivity often has this kernel of name and form that we're reacting from, right? There's this little prick that happened, this impulse, this point of thought, of hearing someone, seeing something, that created this whole quality of reactivity. See if you've had that experience of going back and reconnecting with that point of name, of contact, and seeing how the impulse to act from it flows out. So sharing that with each other, and as always with these small groups, holding what's said in the group in confidence, confidentially, and monitoring your own time. And we'll have about 20 minutes for this process. And then I'll bring us all back for the larger group and a chance to ask any questions. All right. And if you have any questions, feel free to send a chat to myself or to Khaled. All right, so I'm going to break us up into small groups. Yes.
It's Sarah.
Hi, Sarah.
Hi. My question is around, I appreciate the tangible examples you gave of the tree and last week of the puzzle. I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit more about those intangible places that name and form come up in terms of colleagues, friends, family members, relationships, where it's less like the tree viewed from all of these different angles, but more like when someone is difficult to deal with, or when someone is a joy to be around, or when, you know, all of those other, like more of the emotional side of name and form when we're relating to other people.
Yes. Yeah. It's a great question, Sarah, that, because it's like that ski slope I gave the example of. It's like when we have that interaction with another person, we're suddenly very much, you know, caught up in this whole sense of reactivity. It's like this fast slope that before we know it, we're in the midst of it. And so like with the example, you know, throughout our lives, we have many things which we have kind of a neutral inherent reactivity to. So learning to practice with that process of changing name and form, and those can be helpful. But when you get someone like a colleague or a friend or a family member, you know, basically triggers us, right? That's what we're talking about, that sense of reactivity, that sense of being hooked by this other person. It's like we're already really on that fast ski slope. We're right in the middle of this whole, we've already given birth to ourselves and we're caught in this sense of selfing around it. So how to kind of back out of that is, you know, often takes a certain level of changing that level of consciousness, saying, okay, what else in this moment can I pay attention to, you know, as a way to find that place of stability, that place of a little bit more perspective, because our mindfulness, our attention itself has become co-opted by this thing that we're so reactive to, that one comment that just triggered that such a tender spot in ourselves. So intentionally shifting your awareness, shifting to something else, that starts to soften and rebalance the mindfulness so then we can go back to that charged thing. Now, once we can able to go back to it without becoming so caught up like a, you know, like a person falling down the ski slope and making a bigger snowball, we can start to bring the power of investigation to bear to actually say, okay, what's really being believed here? It's always surprising that we can be so upset about something, but we're not actually that precise about what we're upset about. We're maybe precise to, or we're focusing on the actions or on what we're going to do, but really noticing that, really that most tender area, that place that everything is kind of emanating from, actually takes a bit of courage. It takes a bit of trust that touching that deeper pain won't cause it to avalanche more. But if we're able to do that from that balance point, again, there's, I kind of walked us through that, having to get that balance of mindfulness, that balance of attention, to turn toward that quality of deeper pain with compassion, you know, that willingness to be next to. So what this looks like, you know, like let's say, so I had this happen just this last weekend. I was had this sense of inadequacy triggered and engaged. And the mind, you know, if I just let the mind go, it kind of goes down its whole self-perpetuating process of like, yeah, I'm so inadequate, da, da, da. And it becomes this really closed loop. But learn to step back and feel that much deeper sense of lack, of not being loved, not being acknowledged, not being important, whatever that shape that might be. And then just being very, this is the tricky part, is being very still with that. Not going into the impulse to act from it, to overcome it, but simply being very tender with it. Like you're listening to a friend who's just had a horrific breakup or a deep loss in their life, and you don't want to rush in there and try to fix them. You just want to be present for them. You just want to listen as deeply and as fully from your heart as you can. So you learn to do that same thing for yourself. So this is what's, we're taking this really hot charge here and coming back to it with a quality of balanced attention, but a compassionate attention. And then from there, we start to see, okay, how does that tenderness create this whole view of the world? How does it create this view of myself in relationship to the world? And if we start to see that, we can see how that is something that's being this mechanism, this assumption that we're taking up. If we're able to follow that even deeper to see how much of that is really true versus condition, we can see through it, the condition part of it, to the actual, the truth of it. We see that this is just something I learned, perhaps as a young child. This is something I learned to navigate the world at one point in my life that may not be so applicable. And there's, and this, so it's, you can see that the, at least the way I'm describing it now, there's this interesting interplay between the psychological and the Dharma. The Dharma element is really seeing how the sense of me forms around this reactivity, this place of hurt. And ultimately we see how that in itself is just another thought. You know, so it's a process that often takes, you know, it takes its own length of time. It's usually not something we can, in a few minutes, go through. But often we have to work with it, have that sense of being patient with it. Because we're right up against the edge of our ignorance, of our blindness, in the midst of that. It's really what we take the world to be, how we take ourselves to be. It's so personal. It's so deep. So it takes time to be willing to see through that and the courage to let that sense of me fall away and seeing what's left. You know, what am I without this deep belief of inadequacy, for example? Does that help? Yeah, thank you, Sarah. All right, are there any other questions or comments? It's like Ron wanted the homework again, so I'll send that out to everyone.
Could I ask?
Hi, Cuba. Yeah.
Hi, Tim.
Nice to see you.
I'm glad to be here. I find sometimes I really appreciate what you're saying about going into the experience, the feeling that arises. And sometimes it deepens my sense of self. Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
Like they become my feelings.
Yes. Yeah, so that sense of going into that tender place, and then it, instead of being a sense of release of self, you actually become more, the sense of self becomes more established. This is really what I'm feeling. And this is this interesting paradox. It's something that I think, it's a really interesting question, because often what happens is we're kind of having this experience of reactivity or being upset about something, and we're going through it. And there's a sense of, I'm having this experience. But it's, again, it's kind of superficial. Maybe we're dealing with the storm instead of the smoke clouds instead of the actual fire. We touch that fire, we actually go into a much more fundamental, foundational piece of who we take ourselves to be. It's like, oh, wow, this is really who I am. You know. But if you're able to see that, say, and you actually can hear yourself saying that, okay, oh, this is who I am, that's very different than just being right. Usually we're just being that. But you say, oh, wow, this is really who I am. I take that so personally. This is like a defining element of myself. And sometimes this is a little embarrassing when we realize, wow, I'm actually kind of arrogant, or I'm really, you know, lustful, or whatever it might be that we don't usually like to show the world. But we also feel that deep resonance of who we are. But the difference is that we're actually seeing it as a state of a statement of who we are, a belief of who we are. Okay, so that little, it's actually just a little bit of a sliver of perspective, a little bit of sense of something observing that sense of me. Right? If that sense of observing that sense of me isn't there, we're just acting from that place of reactivity. We do this often. You know, when I get upset, I just speak from my anger instead of speaking from that sense of knowing that I am being angry. So that sense of intensification, you know, we'll get back to your question in a second. When we get to that intensification of that sense of me, but we're able to observe it, then we start to investigate that itself as just a belief. So it's, yeah, go ahead, Kaba.
So the observing.
Yes.
The I that's observing, the I that is feeling.
Yes.
Where is Nama in that?
Well, that's a very subtle quality of Nama Rupa. You know, that sense of I'm observing myself and I'm giving a name to it. And that name may be Kaba, it may be Tim, it may be just this perspective of observation. So it's a much more subtle quality of Nama Rupa, but yet it still has this, I'm just gonna say that anytime there's a name on Nama Rupa, there's the name and there's also the impulse to act from it. So notice how when you're witnessing, even if it's a very quiet witnessing, there's often this little sense of having to do something with. Maybe make it just a commentary could be enough. Just like, oh, you know, that's kind of good. Or I need to shift it this way a little bit. Sometimes it feels like you have this really quiet, kind Dharma coach on your shoulder that's telling you, okay, a little bit less, you know, a little bit more of this, a little bit more of that. And that sense of being that Dharma coach is so, you can see that little bit of tension there, a little bit of separation that's there. Does that make sense, Kaba?
So the Dharma coach is sort of like another Nama arising?
Yeah. That sense of that little bit of perspective. Again, it's really that little bit of needing to do something with that experience.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you, Tim.
You're welcome. All right, I'm realizing I'm probably changing everybody's view here as I'm doing this. Maybe not. All right, who else has a question? Anything else, Kaba? Is that good? Yeah, good.
Hi, Tim. I have a I guess this reminded me of a question. I don't know if you answered it or not, but I often will, what came to mind is you were saying to be, just sit quietly with some of that. I find that I'm often trying to apply some sort of an antidote to it. And things do eventually change, but there is a strong urge to like do something to make it go away or to fix or for unpleasant stuff mostly, you know, or even some.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. So that's that impulse of Namarupa, that it carries not only that identifies what you're looking at, what you're dealing with, but has that impulse to do something with, to fix it, to alter it. And, you know, something that's adversive, that's unpleasant, tends to have a stronger charge to do something with, a stronger charge to influence and to try to change or orchestrate. And so that's much of our practice, is learning to do that less and less, to learning to meet the moment's experience with as little influence as we can. So by doing that, it has its own expression. And what's the magical part is that we're able to actually allow life to do its own thing. We're suddenly relating to life in a different way. That sense of the subtle self, that subtle witness, can fall away. And we practice that. We practice that from a very, gross level, if you will, a very broad level of simply, you know, can I meet this breath without doing anything with it? That's often the first thing people say, is that when I focus on my breath, I start to alter it. And how do I do that? And so you learn how to let the breath breathe itself. And you allow an itch to come up and not have to act on that itch. And that's teaching us that skill of how to bring that into that much more subtle quality of reactivity. That we see something, we feel pretty balanced and steady in our attention, and this mind state comes up, and then we feel like we have to do something with. And once you, but that can be a really wonderful place of inquiry, to become really curious about, okay, what if I really try to relax that urge to do something with? And it can be a little bit maddening, because that sense of wanting to do something, it's just so subtle, and it just seems, you know, you can be so quiet and so still, and still there's that little bit of rub, right? So that little bit of rub is this subtle quality of Namarupa and selfing that's still there. It can be very, very quiet, right? And at some point, that sense of friction will fall away. And in that falling away, then there is nothing that needs to be done with this moment. There's an inherent perfection in how this moment actually is. And that's not something that's intellectually, you know, thought of. It's not something that you've kind of convinced yourself. It's just a direct seeing of that. It's this whole Tibetan origination falling away, at least for that moment.
Thank you. That's great.
Thank you, David. All right. Who else might have something to share?
Tim, this is Iris.
Hi, Iris.
Hi.
Nice to see you.
Thank you. Same here.
And who's your cat?
This is Smudge.
Hi, Smudge. That's a great name, Smudge.
Yes. So I had an interesting experience yesterday. I was taking a walk in the neighborhood, and it was a beautiful day, and spring is in full bloom. And I looked at, you know, a bunch of trees in a garden, and I immediately thought, oh, it's so gorgeous. And I felt very happy. And then a moment later, I started feeling less happy. I think that I was able to see my clinging to the beauty. I mean, really subtle. Just like want, like this greed kind of moving towards this beautiful sight, and somehow wanting, just there was some very subtle greed in just seeing it. And I think that that just trying to hold on to something just caused like it to be less desirable.
Yes. Yeah, it's a beautiful description of this process. Because when you
first saw, it was so intense. I mean, like to see it.
Yes. It's not a abstract thing when you see it that way. That when you first saw the beauty of nature there, I mean, you were without words. Right. And when there's no words, there's no sense of separation between what's seeing and what's being seen. Or at least it's very subtle separation. It's like there's this sense of simply abiding with this experience. And we've all had that experience when we just are without words for something, seeing a beautiful sunset or seeing a newborn baby, being with someone at the last breath. You know, there's this sense of stillness that just descends upon us. And then our mind comes up and, you know, there's this uncomfortableness with that lack, with that deep intimacy. And our mind offers a word, offers a name. Oh, isn't this beautiful? Right? And that's the nama rupa. And from that nama rupa, that's the springboard for this whole sense of going into to contact, to vedna, to clinging, to craving. Right? And then you felt that sense of separation, that sense of this wasn't quite as magical as it was before I got in there and tried to say how beautiful it was. And that's why it's so beautiful that the process, it's right there. And yet, you know, so you saw that so clearly. That's such a beautiful example of that.
It's crazy. Yeah.
And so now that you see that, start to notice that in other times.
Absolutely.
It's every moment. It's like there's that choice point of do we jump in there and interact with our minds and our story or the actual direct experience? And so we can see it, you know, if we can see it from the beginning like you did, that's really helpful.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it's harder when we're in the midst of the reactivity, right, to kind of back out of that.
Mm-hmm.
But even in the midst of the reactivity, we can start to let that pass.
Yeah.
Thank you for sharing that, Iris.
Thank you.
Seems to be working pretty well for people to unmute themselves. And if you can't figure out how to unmute yourself, you're welcome to send a chat if you can figure that out at the bottom, the little bubble there, like a dialogue bubble.
Hey, Tim, just a quick question.
Yes.
So in a similar way, how sometimes we might label our thoughts or sensations as kind of neutral or pleasant or unpleasant, would that apply to labels as well? So tree, I suppose, might be neutral, but wood, you know, lumber is maybe pleasant if you're a lumberjack and, you know, view blocker and so on. So would you recommend sort of doing that to the words that we're using?
Yeah, So the question is around, you know, that labeling of pleasant, unpleasant, neutral, and can that we bring that into the sense of nama rupa itself. You know, labeling has, it's kind of a two-edged sword. It's a technique that's employed by many teachers to bring a sense of consciousness to the fact that we are applying this mental label to something. You know, often, like if you have a repetitive state of mind, that can be really helpful to bring that in. Okay, I'm planning. The double-edged sword of it is it's also using the mind to think about the mind. So it's kind of helpful to kind of give the mind something to do that's more oriented to what's present. So I would say there's two ways to answer this. One is for you particularly, the way I know your practice. Another one is more generally. So just to talk, so say generally, I think it can be helpful to do that, to notice, okay, there's tree, or maybe there's the more specific label like wood or oak, and noticing the impulse that comes from that. So actually articulating it, brings a quality of clarity. It's like that really clear seeing what's this big, this, you know, the impulse that's driving this whole process. It's being much more clear about it, much more exact, can be helpful, especially if it starts to become really tiresome to do that. If you start to say, oh, there's the wood, you know, you start to see, okay, there's the tree itself, and there's my label I've placed on it. And you start to become tired of your own labels. That's ultimately what's helpful, is when we become disenchanted with that knee-jerk or that tendency to always label. Like with the last question, with that sense of seeing the beauty of nature and saying, why do I always have to comment on how beautiful nature is? Can I just experience it? Yeah, so that's particularly helpful if you use it that way, that to get to that place of disenchantment, a disillusionment with the process. It'll also bring that sense of consciousness to it. So, you know, I would encourage, you know, for yourself personally to notice that label, but also particularly notice the aliveness of that relationship that's outside of the label. The aliveness of the heartfelt connection to something, and how the sense of label creates orders life. It creates a place for life, but also creates a sense of separation. So that choice of, am I willing to let the world be less orderly, less categorized, you know, let the Dewey Decimal System fall away, so that it is the direct experience of life. And, you know, the trade-off of that is, you know, you might be a little bit confused at times. But the other side of that is that there's a deep intimacy and aliveness and ease, because you're getting much more connected to that place where you have nothing to do with, nothing needs to be done with this experience.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you, Khaled. Right, anyone else? We have maybe time for one more question or so.
I have a question, but I don't have any light on. It's Lori.
Hi, Lori.
Hi, Tim. Could you, following up on that, could you speak to the compassion, and where does that compassion arise, that tenderness arise in this process that you just described with Caleb?
With Khaled, the last question?
Yeah, please.
Sarah's
or all, and all, actually, and Iris too. Yes.
Questions, yeah, of compassion. Yeah, it's an interesting point of inquiry, isn't it? Because we can have a sense of compassion that is actually another nama rupa, is another process of intentionality. That, okay, I'm going to really practice being compassionate. I'm going to practice turning toward this moment's experience. This moment of pain, of discomfort, of sorrow, that sense of turning toward, is this intentionality. As Narayan will talk about this weekend on the Brahma Viharas, so it's this intentional turning toward it. And so we often need to practice that. We need to develop that quality. And yet there's this other source of compassion, which is more what I was kind of pointing toward. And this is when we're able to drop enough of our story, enough of our argument with how life is, and our drop enough of our need to make life a different way. And suddenly our hearts start to emerge. There starts to be this different way of relating to life that's not filtered through our thoughts, that's not filtered through our reactivity. It's a way of relating to life that comes from this sensitivity, this sense of caring. And when that's happening, there's this inherent quality of not having to do anything with. It's simply being with is enough. Being next to is enough. And once that connection is there, then there's this deeper quality of, okay, what is really needed of in this moment? Not from our normal fixing mode. We're not our normal uncomfortableness with someone else's discomfort, with our own problems, but from a much deeper place. That's often seems, it's transcended. It's transcending our normal reactivity, our normal way of selfing. In that way, the compassion seems to emerge from a really from this place of stillness, this place of inner connection. And sometimes we only can learn that when there's no other choice, when we can't fake it anymore, when we can't try to be compassionate, when there's only true compassion that arises. And sometimes the most difficult situations teach us that, whether we want it to be taught or not. All right, how's that, Laura? Lori?
Yeah, wonderful. Thank you so much.
Thank you. All right, so we're almost at our 7 o'clock time. I'm going to send out a quick chat with the information for Donna, for Sims, and for myself. So you can go to our Sims website under donate. You can donate to the organization and also to any of the teachers, Tori, myself, or Carrie, or you could, there's some information about a PayPal directly to me. And Narayan's coming this Friday, then a few days, and she's excited about the weekend, and I think it's going to be a lovely time together. So I hope you can join us. So I'd like to thank everyone. Thank you for your kind attention, and I'll give us a few minutes of unmuted time to chat and say goodbye and wish everyone well.